May it please the court, Nicole Walker on behalf of the appellant, Leslie Small. Mr. Small's substantial constitutional rights were violated at the penalty hearing in this case where it was determined that the death sentence should be imposed. First, the state was repeatedly during the closing arguments mischaracterized Mr. Small's presentation in the mitigation case as an opportunity to excuse his conduct and to shift the blame. Additionally, the prosecutor was permitted to solicit a comment from its expert that allowed the jury to draw a negative inference on his exercise of his constitutional rights. Because these violations jeopardized the fairness and integrity of the penalty hearing, his death sentence should be vacated.
Let's start with the second point first, just so I'm sure I understand the record.
Yes.
And did your client confess in this case?
Yes, Your Honor.
And was the confession introduced into evidence?
I believe so, yes.
So to the extent there was a comment on his right to remain silent, is your argument there ought to be a per se rule that that constitutes reversible error? Or what was the prejudice in making the comment, given the fact that his confession was already in evidence?
Yes. The problem with the state's argument with regard to that is that we're not talking about the content of what he said when he waived the rights. The question was, you know, could the state comment on the events and on what he said of the events? Sure, they could. The problem was his prior invocation, okay, that he made when he talked to the doctor was actually permissible. And so when the state negatively commented on that, it allowed the jury to draw some adverse inferences. So they actually have nothing to do with each other. The problem is not that an admission was entered into evidence or what have you. It was they made it look like the defendant was playing games when he invoked it this time, although he waived it a different time. So it actually creates more harm.
So my question remains, is that per se reversible error? And if it's not a per se rule, why would it not be harmless?
It should be a per se rule. And the reason for that is this court and the United States Supreme Court have said that it's impermissible to comment on an individual's constitutional rights to allow a jury to draw a negative inference. And the reason is because the jury already, laymen, already have the natural tendency to draw a negative inference. And the United States Supreme Court has said that several times. And to highlight it, then it is also, by highlighting it, it clearly allows the jury to give credence to that initial reaction to draw a negative inference.
But don't we have a record that shows that this was a tactical decision by defense counsel to agree with this approach?
No, Your Honor. The record does show that it looks like the defense counsel was complicit in what happened, but there's no indication that it was tactical. You know, the cases dealing with tactical decisions show that this was, that they did this to take advantage of it. For example, in Wright versus State, he allowed the introduction of the journal so that he could cross-examine the victim on it. He gained nothing.
Should the defense counsel have the opportunity by way of a Rule 61 proceeding, for example, to explain his conduct?
Well, that's certainly one way to go. However, this court has said that the trial judge is supposed to intervene when improper conduct occurs like that. In this case, the court did take some time to actually consider the issue. However, it made improper factual findings. And so part of the harm here came from the trial court's actual decision. He said that he found that it was necessary to support the quality of Dr. Mechanic's opinion because Dr. Smith-Peter, who was the defendant's expert, had actually talked to him about the event. Now, there's apparently the state and defense counsel interpret what the doctor said differently, but whether he did or he didn't, he said that in voir dire. The jury was never told that Dr. Smith-Peter spoke with Mr. Small about the events. So there was no probative value with respect to discussing whether Dr. Mechanic discussed it or not. The other problem with that is not just that he, you know, I think the state characterized it as they noted that he exercised his rights. That's not what happened here. He said he refused to talk to him. And it's unclear why the state and the court, and I guess defense counsel, thought that that would be a better way to present it to the jury, when in fact stating that he refused to talk to him actually allows the jury to draw the inference that, you know, he's playing games here with the state's expert. And cases where the courts have addressed a characterization as refusal have found that to be improper. Now, with respect to the excuses where the prosecutor characterized Mr. Small's presentation of mitigating factors as excuses.
If I can just interrupt you on
sure.
that point. There are at least two ways that a jury could interpret the prosecutor's comments. One, and the other side is going to argue that it's a stretch, is as an improper comment on the exercise of the Fifth Amendment privilege. The other is simply a flat-out argument that, you know, whatever the mitigating factors are, they shouldn't be given any weight, or at least enough weight, to overcome the aggravating factors. Mm-hmm. So where I'm leading to is that what we have, arguably, is simply an ambiguous prosecutor's comment. Could be taken either way, and if that's the case, then how do we get to harmless, how do we get to clear, plain error?
Well, it's not ambiguous, respectfully, and a lot of courts...
Only one way it can be interpreted?
Okay, because what the prosecutor said, if we look at the, let's look at the closing statement he made, which was, I'm sure I get it correctly, he's referring to the mitigators, and he says, they are fairly appealing reasons to recommend a sentence of life. Mitigators are defined as factors that are to allow the jury to decide whether he should get life, okay? But then he goes on to say, but when you stop and think about each and every one of those mitigators, what you will find is that they are excuses. So he's undercutting what he's just said, that these factors, which were properly offered as mitigators, by saying they were excuses.
So you're saying that in order for us to find plain error, we have to conclude that there's no other construction that can be put on the prosecutor's words.
I don't believe that there is any other construction that can be put on the prosecutor's words in this case, as you go on, especially to look at all the several other comments made in the rebuttal. And to talk about the harm, Your Honor, first, the first problem is it's a misstatement of the law. Mr. Small was not offering excuses. He wasn't. In fact, defense counsel has a duty to present the mitigating factors. The trial court and the jury has a duty to consider them, and this court has a duty to consider them in its proportionality review. So, like in Hunter, when the defense attorney argued reasonable doubt, the prosecutor then came back and said,
well, there's still a gap between misstatement, and you may be right about that, and unconstitutionally improper comment, and you need to bridge that gap.
Okay. It violates the Eighth Amendment, for one thing, and with respect to as part of the due process analysis. And the reason for that is because this court says, we're talking about a death sentence, and the court says they are entitled and required to consider these mitigating factors. What the prosecutor is doing is saying, when Mr. Small gets up here in his allocution, says, I'm not offering excuses. He's lying. He's being disingenuous. That's not what he's doing. And puts the burden on him then to explain, well, what the purpose of the hearing is. For the jury to say, he's saying he's accepting responsibility, but why are we having this whole hearing for him to present excuses?
Did the trial judge make reference to comments by counsel?
In his sentencing decision?
In his instructions to the jury.
Oh, in his instructions, no, he did not.
In either the guilt or the penalty phase?
No, and these were made at the penalty phase, the comments. And
sometimes the instruction at the penalty phase incorporates earlier instructions.
Right.
There's no instruction on statements made by attorneys?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, absolutely. There's a, it is, excuse me, absolutely, they were actually given that instruction. However, they were also told what the definition of mitigating circumstances are, which are exactly what the prosecutor had said were compelling, that they are circumstances to allow for a lesser sentence than death. And several jurisdictions have said characterizing a mitigating circumstance as an excuse is reversible error. In fact, in State versus Bay, it's very similar. In that case, the prosecutor said, child abuse is a horrible, horrible thing, but it's an excuse. He wasn't a child when he killed the victim. In our case, the prosecutor said, referring to Mr. Small's childhood, now the defendant wishes to use those same events to excuse his behavior, and they don't. And that is not what Mr. Small wished to do, and that is not what the defense counsel said. In fact, defense counsel said, if I was offering an excuse, I would have done it in the guilt phase. And the state says, well, that opened the door for us to misstate the law, essentially, is what it amounts to. And it's similar, again, to Hunter, where defense counsel talked about reasonable doubt, but that didn't open the door for the state to then misstate the law on reasonable doubt and say, well, he's trying to confuse you here.
Yeah. And the relief you're seeking in this case is a new penalty hearing only?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. And, you know, this court even has been clear following the United States Supreme Court, saying that the prosecutor errs in discussing the mitigating factors the defense offered is insufficient to mitigate and excuse. And in State versus Klampas that was cited by the state, the court said statements such as ours that say, you know, he's offering excuses is the same as the prosecutor arguing to the jury that the mitigator should not be considered unless it excused and justified the crime.
Can you reconcile Whalen and Taylor?
Both of which Milton Taylor
to speak to this, and let me try to be a little more helpful by quoting from Taylor versus State. The prosecutor said during the penalty phase, quote, the drug problem we recognize, but it shouldn't serve as an excuse, doesn't serve as an excuse for what he did. And this court in 2011 said that was a proper comment, and defense counsel's failure to object to the comment at trial would not change a reasonable sentence the judge's decision on the outcome of the penalty phase.
Yes, and if I recall correctly, I think the judge also said that it might be fair to say that they maybe should have objected. But to answer your question precisely, that's one isolated incident. Here we have about 8 times he used the word excuse. It was part of an entire presentation in saying shifting the blame and countering most, if not all, of his mitigators by using the word excuse. And making it very clear that what, you know, that's what Mr. Small was doing, was trying to excuse
him. Shifting the blame then doesn't mean someone else did it. He didn't. It means that there are factors beyond his control that caused him to act the way he did, which should mitigate against the death penalty. Is that?
I respectfully disagree, because blame is, I killed this person, but I did it because of my childhood. And that's not what he's doing. He's saying, okay, I killed this person. I shouldn't have done that. Please don't kill me. But here's why, because of my childhood or because of whatever else he offers.
So if I understand your response to the Chief Justice's question, it's that in Taylor, the offensive word was stated once, but here it was repeated.
Yes.
It's like the difference between a drum beat and a drum roll.
Exactly. And it was throughout his entire presentation.
Was there an objection to any of those?
No, Your Honor, there was not. But as this court has stated in Baker versus State, it is for the trial judge to step in whenever the prosecutor says something improper. Additionally, this court in Wainwright said, you know, just because, even if there's invited error, that does not necessarily erase the appellate review.
Well, but if I understand your argument, you know, we've talked about not using the word wire in closing arguments. So
sure.
Anybody litigating a case in Delaware that hears the word liar is immediately going to be on alert.
Right.
And you seem to be making the argument that in a death penalty case in the penalty phase, the word excuse should put people on alert also. So my question is, how can someone defend a death penalty case and in the penalty phase hear the word excuse so many times and not object?
I can't answer that question, why that didn't happen in this case. But unfortunately, it didn't happen. And we're in a situation where we're dealing with a death sentence, and this court has the opportunity to correct what went wrong in this case and what the prosecutors have said was wrong. It wasn't just the use of the word, it was the application and the significance of that word with respect to the argument that they were making to the jury. Unless the court has any other questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, good morning. As to all three arguments, context means everything. And I say three arguments because they don't even pay attention to the mandatory death penalty review that this court must engage, that the state did brief, and we would ask the court to look at that as the proportionality of Mr. Smalls. But looking to the two arguments that they did brief, obviously the trial counsel and appellate counsel are grossly disconnected, and it's a disturbing trend that we see on our side of the aisle, quite honestly. They are saying that the counsel from their office was so inexcusably neglectful that they should have been on their feet and did nothing. As to the first argument, counsel actually understood exactly what was going on. That counsel had sought the ability to have his client evaluated psychologically to put in mental health evidence, got an order from the Superior Court saying, oh, the state can do it too, but the state doesn't get to see the results, doesn't get to see the report of their own expert until after the guilt phase, not knowing that the defendant wouldn't talk to their expert, wouldn't talk to the state's expert about the incident, which the state then probably could have gone to the court and said, wait a minute, this isn't a Fifth and Sixth Amendment issue any longer. He put this into play. This isn't, if you look at all the cases that they speak to, every one of the cases they speak to are cases about pretrial silence and police officers talking about that. Not, we put mental health illness into play. We put mental health into play. We get an evaluation. The state gets an evaluation, but doesn't get to ask certain questions.
Mr. Wallace, just if I can interrupt for a moment, I'm not quite clear where this argument's going. Is it your contention that the omission of the trial defense counsel to object in both of these circumstances was a tactical, deliberate decision, or are you arguing that this is, in Justice Ridgely's words, a slow-moving Rule 61?
It's not a slow-moving Rule 61, nor is it necessarily a tactical decision. It's an absolute understanding of exactly what was going on in that courtroom at that time. Counsel got the psychological evaluation. Counsel got the state's basically cloaked away from their own expert's evaluation. Counsel told his client, hey, when the state psychiatrist talks to you, don't talk about the incident. He knew that. The state didn't know that until after the guilt phase.
Sorry, I didn't know there was any middle ground between a tactical decision and a rule and ineffective assistance. That's where you seem to be locating this decision of counsel, whatever it was.
Well, tactical decision to me speaks more to I am going to make a specific decision to litigate this or not litigate this in a specific way, as opposed to saying
I'm going to deliberately not object when counsel, when the prosecutor uses the word excuse, and I'm not going to object when you know the argument is made about the refusal to talk to whoever.
I guess the difference is tactical decision is recognizing that something is wrong and in fact may violate the Fifth or Sixth Amendment and saying, but I'm going to hold back on that. Instead, what trial counsel understood is what the state is arguing here. There was no Fifth and Sixth Amendment violation because he had no Fifth and Sixth Amendment right anymore to not speak to the psychiatrist about those issues. Counsel understood that. Trial counsel understood that. It gets to the other end of the PD's office and they claim plain error. And they say, well, look at these Fifth Amendment cases in a totally different context. We can say that his right to counsel was violated when his counsel told him, don't speak to the state psychiatrist.
But your position is, once you put the mental health in issue, you have to, by virtue of that, waive your Fifth Amendment rights and talk to whoever the mental health expert is so they can make an evaluation. So therefore, in this case, since it was the defendant's attorney's idea to get the mental health evaluation, the defendant's attorney waived the Fifth Amendment right, so it was inconsistent to ask for an evaluation, then direct your client not to speak.
Yes, exactly. And in fact, if you look at the case that they cited to the Superior Court to then cloak the state away from their own expert and what he found, U.S. versus Beckford, that court specifically says there's no Sixth Amendment issue with forcing the defendant to undergo the psychiatric evaluation. You don't get to say, you state you get to do the evaluation, but you only get to ask him certain questions. It's no longer a Fifth or Sixth Amendment question. He, through counsel, has asked to be evaluated and to perhaps introduce mental health evidence. And all it's well known, then the state gets to put on rebuttal evidence and gets to develop that evidence. I'll tell you, quite honestly, when I read the record and saw that the state was kept away from its own expert's evaluation so that the prosecutor really couldn't do anything about the fact that Mr. Small, through his counsel, wouldn't talk about the incident, he's stuck there at the penalty phase then saying, what do I do with that? I've got what a juror might believe is a very faulty evaluation when our own expert didn't even ask him about the crime. And that's what he was trying to get to. And that's why I'm suggesting the attorney sitting there, the defense attorney says, yeah, I did tell him that. And what the prosecutor's trying to do is not make it look worse by saying he hid behind his lawyer to not talk about the incident and just laid it out to the court, laid it out with the defense attorney, and the defense attorney said, that's fine.
Okay, so you basically you're arguing two related things. Number one, that as you responded to Justice Holland, there was a waiver of any Fifth Amendment privilege. And secondly, the characterization of the refusal to talk was accurate.
Yes. And so that there is no issue there. As to the second argument, the...
Is there a difference, Mr. Wallace, between a mitigator and an excuse?
Depends. They're awfully hard as a... I think that to say a mitigator is never an excuse would be wrong, or is never excuse making would be wrong. I think where the courts have drawn the line is this, that the state can never say, you can't consider this a mitigator unless it excuses his behavior. The Kansas Supreme Court, I think, said that relatively clearly. And in getting back to the Chief Justice's question about trying to resolve Whalen and Taylor, I think what the court in Whalen was saying was exactly that. There was very little discussion of that issue in Whalen, but if you look at the thrust of it, it was prosecutors can't say, you, to be a mitigator under the law, it has to excuse or justify his behavior. That's true.
Don't you think by now we would see the word excuse used in a very sparing way, and that most prosecutors would just stay away from the word excuse and come up with something else, like explanation?
Honestly, I don't know. I don't believe so. There's been little, since Whalen in 1985, there's been little litigation about that. Quite honestly, I think if you look through transcripts of penalty hearings and penalty arguments by prosecutors, you've probably seen the word excuse quite a bit, or justify quite a bit. Because it was
words that... It's also ambiguous, isn't it? That is, it could be used in the sense of negativing liability, criminal or otherwise, or it could be used in the sense of mitigating a penalty. So why would the prosecutor, how does it advantage a prosecutor to inject an ambiguous word like that that leads to nothing more than the kind of colloquy we're having now?
Your Honor, I think because the prosecutors in this case used it exactly as this court had approved it in Taylor. If you look at almost each and every circumstance, what the prosecutor is saying is, he talks about, gosh, I didn't get drug treatment, I didn't get follow through with it, and then explains, yeah, because he washed out of it. So he tries to excuse his not getting drug treatment by his own activity. And in almost each and every circumstance, the prosecutor isn't saying, this doesn't excuse this murder.
Well, let's go back to what the Chief Justice read from Taylor. It appears to say, first, it wasn't plain error, and second, that it wouldn't have made any difference. But where does Taylor condone that? When we say something is not going to be reached on a plain error standard, and it didn't constitute independent reversible error, does that mean that we condone it?
Well, Your Honor, I think that when the court quotes the prosecutor, the drug problem we recognize, but it shouldn't serve as an excuse, doesn't serve as an excuse for what it did. This is a quotation from Taylor. Those remarks occurred during Taylor's penalty hearing and were properly made to counter mitigating evidence presented by Taylor's counsel. I mean, I think when this court says they were properly made to mitigate to counter the mitigating evidence, I think that's a condonement of making that type of argument. And I think that's exactly what the prosecutor was doing here, saying he wants to say you should consider this as a mitigator. But that behavior can't be excused because he washed himself out of treatment. He committed the other crime. I mean, they went through the different mitigators and say that past behavior isn't excused because of his activity. They never made the final, inappropriate jump to say you can't consider any of those things unless they legally excuse what he did here. I think that's where Kleypas and I think that's where Whalen draw that line.
But isn't that what you're saying to the jury when you say he's trying to present this as a mitigator, but really it's just an excuse, meaning it is not a mitigator?
No, what they're saying is, and what they did say, like I said, by saying that past behavior isn't excused because of, you know, he voluntarily left treatment, or he committed more crimes, or he did X, Y, or Z, or he turned away from his family because
I guess that's I'm having trouble when you're talking about past behavior being excused. If someone gets life in prison, that doesn't excuse the past behavior. It's a form of punishment, just like capital punishment is a form of punishment. And so isn't that a distinction that's important to keep clear before the jury?
I apologize if I'm not following the court's question exactly. I believe that they were making a clear argument to the jury and not saying, look, you can only consider this as a mitigator if it excuses the murder of June McCarson. What they're saying is he wants to bring these mitigators up. He wants to say, I had this past behavior, but I had a reason for it. My family didn't love me enough, or whatever it was. That's excuse-making for that past behavior. That's excuse-making for that. That's not taking full responsibility. And you have to look at it in the context of this entire argument. He gets up and says, I'm taking full responsibility for what I've done. I'm not making any excuses for any of my past behavior. That's not what his mitigator said. His mitigator said...
Well, maybe I... Now, understanding your distinction for the first time, you're relating the word excuse to mitigating past behavior as if it has nothing to do with the crime that they're trying to decide the appropriate penalty for. Is that right? You're making this distinction between whether there's some type of mitigation, quote, excuse for past behavior versus a mitigation, quote, excuse for the penalty in the crime that the jury is looking at.
And I think that even the prosecutor can say, look, all of that doesn't justify what he did here, doesn't excuse what he did here. But what he can't say is, and you can't consider it unless it does, because that's a misstatement of the law.
Well, it is a misstatement. Was that implicit in the argument that was made or not?
Now, I'd suggest that as you go through each one, no, it was not.
Let me say in answer to Justice Ridgely's question and Justice Berger's earlier question, I was with you until you characterized those responses the way you're characterizing now. Let me just take your advice and give you some examples and explain to me how this language is not supportive of an answer quite different than you gave Justice Berger. Here,
in closing argument, the prosecutor said, "The defense witnesses have provided you with a number of mitigating circumstances which they claim weigh in favor of the recommendation of life. All of those things are true. They are fairly appealing reasons to recommend the sentence of life. But when you stop and think about each and every one of those mitigators, what you will find is that they are excuses." Then he says, in rebuttal, with no opportunity for defense counsel to respond, he quotes the defense attorney as saying, "No excuses, no excuses." The prosecutor then says, "Call it whatever you want. It's an effort by the defendant to shift the blame to people other than himself. If they don't want to call that excuses, then don't call it excuses. But that's what it is, an effort to shift the blame to someone else." Now, how can you fairly characterize that as simply, "Jury, don't weigh the mitigators in the way the defense counsel asked you to weigh them," when you undertake your task of determining the aggravating factors, weighing the mitigating factors, and then considering life as opposed to the death penalty?
Your Honor, I think that the difference is this. I don't know, I don't believe that a prosecutor's argument that certain behavior doesn't excuse even the murderous conduct here is a wholly improper argument. But where you would step over the line, and it wasn't done at either time there, is you can't consider these things. As a matter of law, you can't consider these things unless they excuse his behavior, because that is incorrect. Because mitigation is anything that might, anything about his past, anything about him that might make life more appropriate. But to say, "Look, that doesn't excuse his behavior here," isn't a wholly improper argument. It just isn't. It's only when the prosecutor steps over that line and says, "And you can't look at it unless it does. You can weigh it less if it doesn't." Certainly that's a fair argument by a prosecutor.
Well, how do you characterize shift the blame to someone else?
And I think if you look at the words right before the shift the blame, he's really talking about all of the things he's done. I think you have to go back and look at the mitigators about, you know, his traumatic childhood, his parents placed him in a residential treatment center at 16, he wasn't provided any short-term or long-term substance abuse. He was adding up the every one of these things where he says, "Well, gosh, I'm a drug addict because I didn't get treatment or whatever." The prosecution also presented that's because he voluntarily left treatment or he did other things. And I think the prosecutor is taking that totality of evidence and saying everything that he wants to say is bad about his past, that's a mitigator, he's really trying to blame somebody else. His parents were not doing X, Y, or Z, or him leaving his own treatment. He blames somebody else for this crime, necessarily.
Just before that last phrase I read to you, the prosecutor went into a discussion about accountability, saying that the defendant only accountable when he's up against the wall. And he says, when he's up against the wall today with you all, quote, "I'm accountable." He didn't do that. He said, "No excuses," the defense counsel, "no excuses, call it whatever you want." Why this accountability argument that he's not facing up to the fact and holding himself accountable because he's offering these excuses by shifting the blame to someone else for what happened? How is that a denigration of mitigating factors and not a shift in the burden of proof?
Your Honor, it's a denigration of the mitigating factors because he is saying this is Leslie Small's pattern and practice through his criminal behavior and his criminal career. He never holds himself accountable. He'll always make an excuse, and that's what we've seen. This man was a career criminal, been through and washed out of, you know, numerous substance abuse treatment programs, was back on crack now. And what he's saying is, look, that's an aggravator. He makes all these excuses. He never takes responsibility until his back's up against the wall. So question him now when he says, "I'm not making any excuses." Why is it any different than then?
Non-statutory aggravators?
Excuse me?
Was that a non-statutory aggravator?
I'd have to look at the list. I don't recall whether it was or not, Your Honor. I don't know if it was a listed non-statutory, never takes accountability. I don't know if it was made in that so many words.
You may have answered this and I may have missed it, but do you have any response to your colleague's argument that Taylor can be distinguished because it's discussing a single instance of using the word excuse, and here there was a repetitive focus on the mitigating factors are not excuses?
Your Honor, I guess I would go back to what I believe I had said before, and that is when you then take that use of excuse, it ties back to previous behavior, just like in Taylor, it ties back to the drug problem. The drug problem we recognize, but it should not be an excuse. Each time when the prosecutors are talking about excuse making, they're tying it back to some specific mitigator that he had, and the fact that you shouldn't take that as a mitigator because his behavior brought about what he claims now is mitigating.
So the repetitive comments about excuses, you believe, are directed to individualize specific instances of mitigating factors?
One of the mitigating factors that they talk about. Now, look, do they talk about them in some, as the courts just quoted? Yes, they do. But I think it's leaving on to that theme, and that is Leslie Small never wants to hold himself accountable. He's had a terrible criminal history. He's excuse made through it, and he's doing so now.
So this is not like Taylor, where it says the drug problem we recognize, or the prosecutor said the drug problem we recognize, but it shouldn't serve as an excuse. That comment is directly tied to a specific identifiable mitigating factor. And these comments we've just discussed are, as you put it, generalized comments about mitigating factors not being excuses. That's a distinction.
Generalized to these mitigating factors that Leslie Small has
not directly specified as in Taylor.
The ones that your Honor just read, no. But that's kind of the wrap up of going through various ones and making arguments about, you know, he says his family abandoned him and things like that. And I think we laid that out in our answering brief where we talk about where these excuse arguments were made and the fact that then they added up to, you should give that less weight.
It's helpful to people like me, though, to hear someone argue it. That's why we have oral argument. In fact, it's in the briefs. It's helpful, but oral argument, to me anyway, is much more helpful.
thank you, Your Honor. The state suggests that this is much more the Taylor situation than the Kleypas or Whalen situation, where a prosecutor would have misled or could have misled a juror into believing that as a matter of law, it can only be a mitigator if it excuses it. Prosecutors here never said such a thing. Interestingly, defense counsel never made an objection. Why? Because they understood the nature of the argument that was being made. As this court has said time and time again, the nuances, what's going on in the courtroom, what the jury hears, what the defense counsel hears, and what the court hears, are incredibly important in putting these things in context. The one last point to be made is, I don't know that we've been in the situation under the current death penalty law where the juror's vote is a recommendation, but the judge makes the final determination. So even if Small were to get relief, what relief would that be? Would it be going back to the trial judge to discount those arguments in his final analysis, or give some less weight to the juror's thing if he believes they were poisoned in some way? I don't know that we've ever come across that in the straight penalty phase situation that we have here. Almost every penalty phase that I can think of either was reversed under the other one where the jurors vote and was binding, or a situation, for instance, under the new law where I think we had a recusal situation with a trial judge and we had to have a new penalty phase because of that. Honestly, the idea that, well, we just reverse. I mean, if you look at the prayer in the end of the opening brief, they say you should reverse the convictions and sentence.
Well, isn't the practice, though, that the argument to the jury is also the argument to the judge?
Yes. And so the question...
There's a separate proceeding where there's a more, quote, sanitized argument could have been made.
That's true. And in fact, the current death penalty statute prohibits that, prohibits any further argument. It says the court should not take any further evidence or argument also. Where there shouldn't be another separate hearing where there's more made. But if it's a trial judge and sentencing judge who had heard that argument, certainly he or she can say, okay, the Supreme Court says I should exclude the excuse arguments made by the state and reweigh, if that's required. And I would suggest that if there would be any type of relief, that would be the one that would be given.
Would we then be ignoring the significance of a jury vote?
I don't know that we're ignoring the significance of a jury vote, Your Honor. I think that a sentencing judge can take into account whether or not that is in any way compromised because of error.
Thank you.
To start with, I want to make something clear about the proportionality argument. It's not that defense counsel completely ignored it, but based on a review of the law, the record, the court's decision, if the court fails to reverse on the excuses argument or the Fifth and Sixth Amendment argument, we have no good faith basis to argue that it's disproportionate, and that's why it was not included. That does not mean we don't suggest that the court should not conduct its own proportionality review as required by law. Couple things. One, with respect to the final point that Mr. Wallace said, was that the judge versus jury rehearing what should matter. The court did say in its decision, looking to the the physical and neurological complications that Mr. Small had, that they did not have anything to do with what happened on the day of the events. And he did point to that when he made his findings. So while not completely clear, it does suggest that the court did reject it because it did not excuse his conduct on that day. And to answer the court's question with respect to the difference between an excuse and a mitigator, in Eddings versus Oklahoma, the court said that mitigators do not suggest an absence of responsibility for the crime. Rather, it is relevant to consideration of sentencing. And that is the distinction. And it appeared to me that Mr. Wallace on appeal is making the same arguments that were made below. It's irrelevant if the conduct didn't excuse the events that occurred. If they weren't saying that mitigators are excuses, then what was the point of making the argument? And again, it seems to equate mitigators with excuses, which is improper. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and assess.
Aye.